Jeffrey Holland, born and raised in St. George, received his bachelor's and master's degrees with highest honors from BYU. He went on to receive master's and PhD degrees in American Studies from Yale University, where he was a university fellow. During the course of graduate study, he taught religion courses at BYU and institute courses for the church educational system. He has also been director of the LDS Institute of Religion in Seattle, Washington. His forum address today will make use of doctoral research conducted at Yale University for a dissertation entitled Mark Twain's Religious Sense, The Viable Years, 1835 to 1883. Commissioner Holland is very much in demand as a speaker and frequently contributes articles to the Ensign magazine. As I noted earlier, Sister Pat Holland is with us today, as are members of the Commissioner's staff, and I think many of their companions are seated in the audience. We extend a very warm welcome to each of them. Brother Holland has occupied a variety of church positions. He has served in the calling of a bishop, high counselor, and in two different stake presidencies. He was serving with Academic Vice President Robert K. Thomas as a counselor to President Thomas in the presidency of the BYU Fourth Stake at the time of his assignment as commissioner. A variation of his forum address was given originally as a red lecture. We persuaded Jeff Holland to repeat this superb address, Soul Butter and Hogwash, Mark Twain and Frontier Religion. Commissioner Jeffrey Holland.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here with my wife. Hope that you'll have an occasion to listen to me and look at her. That's a better combination. I'm a little uneasy about this address. As President Oakes mentioned, I gave a slightly longer version of it once before and was thereafter summarily dismissed from the university. I was told to gather my thoughts and leave, which I did, with some trepidation, I go forward. I will read most of this because of the compression that I need for time. When discussing Mark Twain's religious attitudes, his biographers have characteristically focused on the last decades of his life, those final frustrating years in which Twain said going to church gave him dysentery. Nevertheless, the early years, the Western years, as it were, are crucial to any real understanding of Twain's attitude toward religion, revealing moments of a remarkable religious experience and providing the backdrop against which those last decades, so full of financial strife and personal tragedy, must be seen. It is of the early period, completed before he was 50 years old, that I wish to speak. Twain frequently called his religious life Presbyterianism, the faith of his mother's family. But that label became for him a kind of shoebox repository into which he shoved everything, from the faith John Knox espoused to the most nebulous sort of Christian belief. Unlike his friend William Dean Howells, who worried a great deal about the difference between a Unitarian and a Universalist, Twain did not have a mind turned to fine theological distinctions. But he did have a soul gripped by the Puritan fathers, a grip which relentlessly affected his moods and his metaphors. He named his house cats, rather apocalyptically, famine, pestilence, Satan, and sin. He thought the height of confidence was a Christian holding four aces. Smugness was a friend waiting for a vacancy in the Trinity. And so on, ad infinitum. Or for him, ad nauseum. Fear, punishment, conscience, duty, the hand of God, death, these were the staples in his moral pantry. A compulsive guilt seeker, he blamed himself for at least the deaths of a brother, a son, and a daughter, and he finally despised the human race because it included men like himself. As his closest minister friend Joseph Twitchell once said, Sam Clemens was simply too orthodox on the doctrine of total human depravity. This religious preoccupation and subsequent struggle is brilliantly, if unwittingly, posed in that earliest boyhood image of the ponderous Word of God suffocating an already dying man. Twain wrote in his autobiography, and I quote, "The shooting down of poor Smar in the main street at noonday supplied me with dreams, and in them I always saw again the grotesque closing picture, the great family Bible spread open upon the profane old man's breast by some thoughtful idiot, adding to the torture of its leaden weight to the dying struggles. We are curiously made. In all that throng of gaping and sympathetic onlookers, there was not one with common sense enough to perceive that an anvil would have been in better taste than that Bible, less open to sarcastic criticism and swifter in its atrocious work. In my nightmares, I gasped and struggled for breath under the crush of that vast book for many a night. For the most part, he gasped and struggled under the crush of it for most of his life. The first Sunday school Sam Clemens attended in Hannibal, Missouri, was held in the then newly finished Methodist Church, known as the Old Ship of Zion, and the teacher of Sam's class there was a stonemason by the name of Richmond. He was a very kindly and considerate Sunday school teacher, Sam recalled, more than half a century later, and he was never hard on me. For the nearly 3 years he attended the Old Ship of Zion, Sam remained under Mr. Richmond's spiritual care, and out of those few years and fond memories came the seeds of a remarkable literature. As his literary advisor and most perceptive friend later observed, there are no more vital passages in his fiction than those which embody character, as it is affected for good as well as evil, by the severity of the local Sunday schooling and church going. It is unlikely that Sam ever attended the Methodist Church after his 8th year, yet perhaps because of the fondness with which he remembered his experience there, it remained in his imagination as the setting for episodes which took place well into his adolescent years. In 1848, all the Clemens family, but Sam's father, formally joined the Presbyterian Church, much to the delight of his grandmother Casey, who always said her favorite doctrine was predestination. It was then that young Sam learned, in Howell's famous phrase, to fear God and dread the Sunday school. As often as it seemed advisable, the boy would violate the Sabbath by rolling rocks down Holiday Hill or by swimming in the Mississippi River. Of course, providential displeasure with this latter sin was serious wrath to incur, and it was done at the very peril of one's soul. Sam said he was nearly drowned 9 times as a boy, and he didn't need any sermons to read the divine warning in those fateful moments. Twain once recalled a schoolmate who'd fallen out of a flatboat in which the boys had been playing. Being loaded of sin, he went to the bottom like an anvil, Twain remembered. That night, the deceased was the only boy in the village who slept. The others were awake and repenting. A funeral sermon on special providence fresh in their ears. As if by appointment, there was the attendant electrical storm with its vicious window-rattling rain and silent-splitting thunder. The description of this youthful horror is so basic to Twain's work that it deserves to be quoted here, even at some length. I quote, "I sat up in bed quaking and shuddering, waiting for the destruction of the world and expecting it. Every time the lightning glared, I caught my breath and judged I was gone. I endured agonies of remorse for sins which I knew I had committed, and for others which I was not certain about, yet was sure that they had been set down against me in a book by an angel who was wiser than I and did not trust such important matters to memory. I resolved to turn over a new leaf instantly. I resolved to connect myself with the church the next day if I survived to see its sun appear. I resolved to cease from sin in all its form and to lead a high and blameless life forever after. I would be punctual at church and Sunday school, visit the sick, carry baskets of victuals to the poor, simply to fulfill the regulation conditions, because I knew we had none so poor among us but would smash the basket over my head for my efforts. I would instruct other boys in right ways and take the resulting trouncings meekly. I would subsist entirely on tracts. I would invade the rum shop and warn the drunkard. And finally, if I escaped the fate of those who early became too good to live, I would serve as a missionary." This is a boyish view of fierce providence and fearful penitence, but it appears one way or another throughout Twain's life and throughout his literature. Indeed, Twain usually saw life, religious and otherwise, through the eyes of a child. His best books are about them, and his wife called him youth all their married life. After his father's death in the boy's 12th year, Sam left school and came even more fully under the supervision of Jane Clemens. He teased and tormented and exasperated his mother all of his life, a devilry she both loved and dreaded. When the neighbors brought Sam to the doorstep to dry out after one more near drowning, she assured them that people born to be hanged are safe in the water. Indeed, his heart belonged to that great river that ran past his Hannibal home. After nearly 20 years of a life that included mining, journalism, travel, and fiction, Sam told the readers the Atlantic Monthly, "I loved the piloting profession far better than any I have followed since, and I took a measureless pride in it. The reason is plain. A riverboat pilot in those days was the only unfettered and entirely independent human being that lived on the earth. To a friend, he once wrote that all men, kings and serfs alike, are all slaves to other men and circumstances, save alone the pilot, who comes at no man's beck or call, obeys no man's orders, and scorns all men's suggestions. Indeed, in later walks of life, it would upset him to have to express his wishes in the weak shape of a request instead of launching it in the crisp language of an order. It seems clear that Mark Twain would never have quarreled with his Presbyterian gods if he only could have been one. On the river, he came as close to that as he was able. With the onset of the Civil War, Sam lost his job on the river and felt he was drifting toward the ministry or the penitentiary. One or the other had seemed an inevitable destination. But his older brother Orion, one of the strangest fellows ever born, saved him from either fate. Orion had been appointed secretary to the new territorial governor of Nevada, and when he had offered Sam the non-paying position of secretary to the secretary, it appeared, said Sam, that the heaven and earth passed away, and the firmament was rolled together as a scroll. With such providential favor working in his behalf, Sam headed west. The trip to Carson City actually took 19 days rather than the usual 17, however, because the Clemens boys discovered that they could not pass so hastily through the newly famous desert kingdom of Brigham Young, Salt Lake City. From his earliest years, Sam Clemens had heard of the Mormons. John Clemens had moved his family into Marion County in eastern Missouri, just months after Jackson County, on the western side of the state, had been declared the New Jerusalem of the Latter-day Saints. The written history of Marion County indicates that Joseph Smith later visited nearby Palmyra, Missouri, considering it as a possible town in which the beleaguered saints might gather. His interest in a city so named will be obvious to this audience. Sam Clemens would have been too young to be aware of such a visit to his neighborhood, but he was not too young to have heard tales of the Hannibal militia, who were alerted at the height of the Mormon conflict, and he may have even seen the cannon that was ready to fire on Mormon immigrants if they steamed too near on their way to Nauvoo, just 40 miles up the river. Twain's response to his Utah visit, including his encounter with Brigham Young, his opinions about polygamy, and his literary fun with the Book of Mormon, are now part of Mormon folklore. We do not have time this morning to review that material. But I'm certain that those of you who have read it will assume you know everything there is to know, and those of you who haven't read it will be thoroughly ashamed. His two-day stay in Salt Lake City left Sam generally impressed with what he called the kingdom. And though he was well-fed and happy at the hands of what he kept calling those homely Mormon women, he was not much wiser regarding the Mormon question. "I left Great Salt Lake a good deal confused as to what state of things existed there," he admitted, "and sometimes even questioning in my own mind whether a state of things existed there at all or not." Tautology notwithstanding, he did determine that the Mormon issue could not be settled in 48 hours, though he admitted some Eastern journalists had been doing it handily in 24. As he started into the desert, he wrote, "Neither hunger, thirst, poverty, grief, hatred, contempt, nor persecution could drive the Mormons from their faith or their allegiance. And even the thirst for gold, which gleaned the flower of youth and the strength of many nations, was not able to entice them. That was the final test. An experiment that could survive that is an experiment with some substance in it somewhere." Sam and Orion made it on to Carson City, but after 2 months in his nonprofit position as observer of affairs of state, Sam succumbed to the silver fever that was by then an epidemic in the Washoe Country. Buying into a few holdings with painfully ironic names like the Golden Fleece, Sam's mining efforts were a disaster by any standard. Most of the time he was destitute financially and depressed emotionally. In the midst of such anxious moments over his prospects, Sam Clemens' personal and professional life was altered forever. As he became more and more disillusioned with mining, he had begun contributing a few humorous pieces to the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise. The sketches caught the eye of the paper's editor, and he offered Sam a position on the Enterprise staff. Reluctant to leave mining, but weary of the disappointments, Sam accepted the offer. It was August of 1862, and he later recalled that he thus stumbled into literature without intending it, simply because he'd failed in all of his other endeavors. "In that month," he said, "I was never so near the ministry in my life." Sam later confided to his brother regarding such occupational joys and sorrows, revealing in a recently discovered letter that the two most powerful ambitions in his life had been to be a pilot on the Mississippi River and a Presbyterian minister. I accomplished the one and failed in the other, he said, because I could not supply myself with the necessary stock in trade, that is, religion. I have given that up forever. I never had a call in that direction, and my aspirations were the very ecstasy of presumption. I have a call, another call, to literature, of a low, humorous order. It is nothing to be proud of, but it is my strongest suit. And if I were to listen to that maxim of stern duty, which says that to do right, you must multiply the one or the two or the three talents which the Almighty entrusts to your keeping, I would have long ago ceased to meddle with things for which I was by nature unfitted, and turned my attention to seriously scribbling to excite the laughter of God's creatures. I wanted to be a pilot, and I wanted to be a preacher, and I was about as well calculated for either as poor Emperor Norton to be Chief Justice of the United States. Let me digress for just a brief aside. There is, in fact, considerable evidence that Sam Clemens seriously considered becoming a minister several times in his life, almost always when he was out of work and desperate. He joked that this most earnest ambition was not prompted so much by his piety as by the fact that it looked like a secure job. It never occurred to me, he said, that a preacher could be damned. When addressing a class of graduating seniors at the high school in Hannibal, Missouri, less than 8 years before his death, Twain told them of his Sunday school boyhood and said, "Often in those days I desired earnestly to stand in that Presbyterian pulpit and give instruction, but I was never asked until today. My ambition of two generations ago has been satisfied at last." More privately, Clemens was genuinely disappointed that in 60 years Hannibal had not produced a solitary preacher, and he was even more dismayed that there had not been at least one minister in his own immediate family. Twain himself tried to fill that gap, always running with those he called the fast nags of the cloth, and admitting he himself was but a moralist in disguise. Indeed, he frequently felt he did a better job of preaching than did the ordained. At 13 years of age, Susie Clemens wrote in her biography of her father, "He doesn't like to go to church at all, and why I never understood until just now. He told us the other day that he couldn't bear to hear anyone talk but himself, and that he could listen to himself talk for hours without getting tired." Of course, he said this is a joke, but I've no doubt it was founded on truth. Well, I return to the time of vocational crisis and decision. It was in those first difficult months in Nevada that Twain found in territorial Christianity one form of the only real religious stance that would appeal to him for any length of time. Like his river experience, it was unorthodox, informal, freewheeling, unfettered. To express it, he took the shooting death of Virginia City saloon owner Tom Peasley and fictionalized it into the immensely popular Buck Fanshawe episode in Roughing It. As Twain wrote it, a friend and fellow fireman named Scotty Briggs appointed himself as a committee of one to arrange for funeral services with the local minister, a young man fresh from an Eastern theological seminary. The following is a condensation of that verbal encounter between New America and New England. "Are you the duck that runs the gospel mill next door?" "Am I? Pardon me. I believe I do not understand you." "The boys thought maybe you'd give us a lift, if we'd tackle you, that is, if I've got the rights of it, and you're the head clerk of the doxology works next door." "Well, I am the shepherd in charge of the flock whose fold is next door." "The which?" "I am the spiritual advisor of the little company of believers whose sanctuary adjoins these premises." "Well, partner, you got the bulge on me, or maybe we both got the bulge somehow. You see, one of them boys has passed in his decks, and we want to give him a good send-off, and so the thing I'm now here to do is roust out somebody to jerk a little chin music, and let's waltz him through handsome." I'm sorry, sir, I seem to grow more bewildered. Your observations are wholly incomprehensible to me. Would it not expedite matters if you restricted yourself to categorical statements of fact, unencumbered with obstructing accumulations of metaphor and allegory?" "I'll just have to pass on that, Judge. You raised me out, pard. If that last lead of yourn is too many for me, I can't neither trump nor follow suit. What we want's a gospel sharp."
"You want a what?"
"We want a gospel sharp. We want a parson."
Oh, why didn't you say so? I am a clergyman, a parson."
"Well, now you're talking. You seem a blind and you straddle it like a man. Now I think we're all right, pard. Let's start fresh. You see, one of the boys has gone up the flume." Gone where? Gone up the flume. Throw it in the sponge. Kick the bucket. Ah. Has departed to that mysterious country from whose bourne no traveler returns. Return, I reckon he ain't part. He's dead. Yes, I understand now. Had deceased any religious convictions? That is to say, did he feel a dependence upon or acknowledge allegiance to a higher power? I reckon you stumped me again, Pard. Could you say it over once more and just a little slower? Well, to simplify it somewhat, was he, or rather had he ever been, connected with any organization, sequestered from secular concerns and devoted to self-sacrifice and the interests of morality? Well, they're all down at 9. Set them up in the other alley, Pard. When you get in there with your left, I hunt grass every time. Every time you draw, you fill, but I don't seem to have any luck. Let's just have a new deal and start over. What? Begin again? Well, the distinctiveness of each man's idiom in this dialogue, it is a dialogue, of course, which is two mutually exclusive monologues, is reinforced by other images in the sketch. Scotty's flaming red flannel shirt against the colorless black cloth of the minister. Briggs's brawny paw with the priest's very delicate hand, and so on. But the ultimate contrast is language, always the most sensitive index to cultural distinctions. On the frontier, there would seem to be little place for men or organizations, quote, sequestered from secular concerns and devoted to self-sacrifice in the interest of morality, unquote. Twain was inviting this fragile, gentle, spiritual new fledgling, as yet unacquainted with the ways of the mines, that's his quote, to come down from the summit of his Sinai and dive, as Herman Melville would say, into the bedrock of human experience and human need. From Nevada, Twain's nascent newspaper and lecturing career took him on to seances in California, proselyting work, that also is his phrase, in the Hawaiian Islands, and ultimately to the midnight missions of New York. In the Orthodox East, Sam found institutional religion to be very unlike Scotty Briggs' more preferable frontier variety, but it was booming business, and as always, he threw himself into the midst of it. He made his way as quickly as possible to the Plymouth Congregational Church in Brooklyn Heights, where every Sunday the dominant Protestant voice and most widely listened to preacher in this nation's history was attracting hordes of people on ferries that quickly became known as Beecher's boats. Inimitably able to sense the popular side of every public question, Henry Ward Beecher was expounding an emotional liberalism that had New York papers reporting the pew renting at Plymouth as if it were a transaction on the stock market. Jamming his way into the church, Twain sat in the congregation and was smitten not with Beecher's theology, but with his mesmerizing platform performance, a style Twain could only describe with phrases like rockets of poetry and mines of eloquence. As he observed the effect it had on the crowd, Twain nearly suffocated with the desire to clap his hands and see if it would break the spell. A short time after attending his first sermon at Brooklyn Heights, Sam presented his letter of introduction to the Reverend Mr. Beecher and accepted an invitation to dinner. Perhaps it was from Beecher himself that he learned of the proposed pilgrimage to the Holy Land being sponsored by Plymouth Congregational. Sam agreed to go, as a dignitary no less, but once on board the Quaker City, he found 67 passengers, including 3 ordained ministers. As the gong sounded that first Saturday evening for the first of an endless succession of prayer meetings, Twain thought he sensed damaging premonitions of the future. Storm outside, pilgrims inside, and prayer meetings everywhere. This was obviously going to be pleasuring with a vengeance. With every mile traveled and every day spent, relationships among the Quaker City group degenerated until somewhere on the plains of Syria, Twain read aloud from the 22nd chapter of Numbers, and then announced to them all that then and forever Balaam's ass was to be the patron saint of the entire group. It was a difficult journey, and yet there were private, reflective moments when Sam was touched by what he saw. Night is the time to see Galilee, he wrote. At night, Galilee is a theater meet for great events, meet for the birth of a religion able to save the world, and meet for the stately figure appointed to stand upon its stage and proclaim its high decrees. But in the sunlight, one says, is it for the deeds which were done and the words which were spoken in this little acre of rocks and sand, 18 centuries gone? that the bells are ringing today in the remote islands of the sea and far and wide over continents that clasp the circumference of this huge globe? One can comprehend that only when night has hidden its incongruities and created a theater proper for so grand a drama. In a sense, this passage is as revealing as any Twain ever wrote about the real contours of his imagination. Not unlike Scotty Briggs' language, it was only a fresh, fanciful, imaginative Christianity he would ever be able to entertain. The harshness of life's sunlit immediacy would conspire to forbid any extended periods of such spiritual contemplation. But he did, however briefly, have his moonlight moments. The return trip from Palestine went from bad to worse. The pleasure trip was a synagogue, a funeral excursion without a corpse, Twain wrote for the New York Herald, as soon as they landed, that a party more ill-fitted by age or awful solemnity for scurrying around the world on a giddy picnic ever went to sea since the world began, I deny most fervently. But like the difficulty of the mines, that discouraging trip was to lead to another monumental turning point in his life, and again a period of intense religious interest. Through the youngest passenger on board the Quaker City, 18-year-old Charles Langdon of Elmira, New York, Mark Twain met and fell immediately in love with the boy's older sister, Olivia. As it turned out, falling in love with Livy Langdon was the closest thing to an Orthodox religious conversion that Sam Clemens ever experienced. On the first anniversary of their meeting, Sam would write, "I did have such a struggle the first day I saw you to keep from loving you with all my heart. You seemed to my bewildered vision a visiting spirit from the upper air, a something to worship reverently and at a distance. Indeed, she came to be his goddess, the only one in which he ever really fully believed." He immediately tried to press his relationship beyond the genteel brother and sister language that Livy insisted upon, and grimly earnest proposed marriage. Stunned by his abruptness, Livy recovered only to say something about his being her brother for as long as he liked, and Byronically, he fled Elmira and wrote back, "I do not regret that I have loved you, still love you, and shall always love you." Pleadingly, he wrote, "Write me something from time to time, texts from the New Testament if nothing else occurs to you, or dissertations on the sin of smoking, extracts from your book of sermons, anything, whatever. The reflection that my matchless sister wrote it will be sufficient. If it be a suggestion, I will entertain it. If it will be an injunction, I will honor it. If it is a command, I will obey it or exhaust my energies trying." When a reply arrived with a small picture enclosed, Sam rushed off a letter worthy of any 19th century tract. "You say to me, I shall pray for you daily. Not any words that have ever been spoken to me have touched me like these. I beg that you will continue to pray for me, for I have a vague, faraway sort of idea that it may not be wholly in vain. In one respect, at least, it shall not be in vain, for I will so mend my conduct that I will grow worthier of your prayers and of your goodwill and your sisterly solicitude as the days go by. Furthermore, and it has taken me a long time to make up my mind to say these grave words, which once said cannot be recalled, I will pray with you, as you ask, and with such faith and encouragement withal as are in me, though feeble and of little worth I feel they must be. It seems strange enough to me, this reverence, this solemnity, this supplication. And yet you must surely have some faith that it will not necessarily be useless, else you would not have suggested it." Sam rushed to Elmira and arrived almost as soon as his letter. Within 24 hours, he'd proposed marriage again. Again, he was refused. A carriage accident as he was leaving the house kept him in the Langdon's home for 2 more weeks, at the end of which he proposed marriage a third time. A third time, the answer was no. Nevertheless, such determination over the following months was finally successful. Ready to leap over church steeples at Livy's acceptance, Sam wrote to a friend, "I touch no more spirituous liquors after this day, though I have made no promises. I shall do no act that Livy would be pained to hear of, and shall seek the society of the good. I shall be a Christian. I shall climb, climb, climb towards this bright sun that is shining in the heaven of my happiness until all that is gross and unworthy is hidden in the mists of darkness of that lower earth. I shall be worthy yet. Livy believes in me. I believe in myself. I believe in God. And through the breaking clouds, I see the star of hope rising in the placid blue beyond. I bow my reverent head." Sam began to pray for Livy. Livy, of course, prayed for Sam. It appears, however, that Mr. and Mrs. Langdon prayed for themselves. They were not entirely taken with this young humorist, and in fact would not give their permission for the marriage. Mr. Langdon wrote a frank letter to his daughter's suitor, rebuking him for some of his drawing room indiscretions, and asking him to relax the pace of the courtship until some reliable character references could be obtained. Unfortunately, there were none to be obtained. Shaken, Sam wrote his prospective father-in-law that while his life had not been entirely unblameworthy on the Pacific coast, nevertheless, quote, "Men as lost as I have found a Savior, and why not I?" Close quote. He wrote to Livy and assured her that he was reading not once but several times the sermons of Henry Ward Beecher contained in the Plymouth pamphlets she regularly sent him. With painful candor, he confessed, "You know the child must crawl before it walks, and I must do right for love of you while I'm in the infancy of Christianity. But then I can do right for the love of the Savior when I have gotten my growth." It was a growth he never obtained, and one more way in which he was always simply a youth. His earlier zeal was simply not sustaining him in such difficult times, and he confessed to her that religion seemed well nigh unattainable, and he felt like giving it up in despair. Yet at that very moment, both of Livy's parents wrote to express their confidence in him, and the millennium itself could not have been more gratefully and enthusiastically received. Now, less than a month away from formal engagement, Sam wrote a letter which probably indicates the summit of his Christian journey, however modest that mountain might be. It seems by every standard to be both genuine in its tone and thoroughly religious in its intent. Dear Livy, let us believe that God has destined us for each other. Let us hope and believe that we shall walk hand in hand in love and in worship of Him. And so journeying, pass at last the shadowed boundaries of time, and stand redeemed and saved beyond the threshold and within the light of that land whose Prince is the Lord of rest eternal. God will bless you in it, will bless us both, I fervently believe. I bless you for your religious counsel, Livy, and more and more every day, for with every passing day, I understand it better and appreciate it more. I am dark yet. I see that I am still depending on my own strength to lift myself up, and upon my own sense of what is right to guide me in the way. But not always, Livy, not always. I do see the Savior dimly at times, and at intervals very near. Oh, would that the intervals were not so sad a length apart. Sometimes it is a pleasure to me to pray, night and morning, in cars, everywhere, 20 times a day. And then again, the whole spirit of religion is motionless within me, from the rising to the setting of the sun. But I do have hope, Livy. I fear I would distrust a religious faith that came upon me suddenly, that came upon me otherwise than deliberately and proven, step by step as it came. You will blame me for this, Livy, but be lenient, for you know that I am groping blindly as it yet. As a matter of fact, Mark Twain would never again have intervals so very near, nor again would he ever grope less blindly. Primarily to please Livy, Sam faithfully rented a pew for the two of them at Joseph Twitchell's Hartford Church, which he always called the Church of the Holy Speculators. Sam never formally joined the congregation, however, although Joe Twitchell did become perhaps the closest personal friend he had in this life, another of those fast nags of the cloth with whom he liked to run. Through this period, Sam was still maintaining some semblance of an orthodox religious life, continuing to say grace at meals, for example. But even that ritual was becoming so malapropos that house guest Thomas Wentworth Higginson equated it to asking a blessing over the performance of European minstrels. With Livy threatening to miscarry, Sam got them all away from Hartford in the spring and summer of 1873. It was a refreshing stay in Elmira and a happy, productive time. He began a manuscript on which he averaged 50 pages a day. The book was to be entitled The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. And in the mind of the author was, at least in the very early stages of the manuscript, a kind of religious reverie, the first act in a proposed Divina Tragedia, set in celestial St. Petersburg, but concluding in hellish Calvinistic reality. The book had been initially prompted by a visit from an old Hannibal Sunday School superintendent, whose voice had brought back trooping phantoms of the past. A church service Twain attended while on the lecture circuit a short time later had reinforced those haunting images. He wrote with evangelical fervor, frequently never moving from his desk for hours. When the book was finished, he considered it a sermon, that's his phrase, a hymn put into prose form to give it a worldly air, he wrote to Howells. But The Adventures of Tom Sawyer was in many ways a flawed work, and Twain sensed that, though he was never a good judge of his own effort. He had not plumbed the real depths of his religious concerns, and he knew, of course, that he had not in that book. In the meantime, his life, particularly his business life, was becoming unbearable. And after trying to find relief up and down the eastern seaboard, on to Bermuda, and finally to Europe, Twain got away from it all by returning to Hannibal to write a book about his river. He enjoyed much of the venture, but for the most part he was deeply, deeply disappointed. He wrote to his wife from Hannibal, "That world which I knew in its blossoming youth is old and bowed and melancholy now. Its soft cheeks are leathery and wrinkled. The fire is gone out of its eyes, and the spring is gone from its step. It will be dust and ashes when I come again. I have been clasping hands with the moribund, and usually they say, 'Sam, this is for the last time.'" The Clemens had already lost their only son, Langdon, and more recently, Livy and the girls were suffering with everything from scarlet fever to diphtheria. Sam, drained economically and emotionally, struggled with the bite of an annual $100,000 in expenses and knew less real peace than he'd ever felt in his life. Largely disenchanted with the river book and the scenes he'd put into it, he immediately began what he wanted to do in the first place, to make a purely imaginative return to the river, to his Hannibal home, and get a less factual, if nevertheless truer, account of a boy's life on that river. Researching life on the Mississippi had triggered a number of ideas, and by midsummer of that year, 1883, he was back at work on the epic that had been on his mind through and had informed parts of Tom Sawyer, The Recent Carnival of Crime in Connecticut, A Tramp Abroad, What is Happiness, and Life on the Mississippi. Twain now hoped to pull together these piecemeal statements he had been making for over a decade. His view of man, religion, and civilization were coming into clearer, if nevertheless darker, focus. Thus, at the height of his creative powers, and farther away than ever from any kind of orthodox religious sympathy, Mark Twain settled down to write The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. He worked more feverishly than at any other time in his life. In August of 1883, he wrote to Howells, "I've done two seasons' work in one. I've written 800 or 900 manuscript pages in such a brief space of time that I must not name the number. I shouldn't believe it myself, and of course I couldn't expect you to." A month earlier, he had written to his mother, "I haven't had such booming work days for many years. I'm piling up manuscripts in a really astonishing way." From the beginning, Twain clearly conceived Huck's quest as an escape from the fetters of Protestant American civilization. In Tom Sawyer, Huck had painted in somber tones the orthodox life he was subjected to at Widow Douglas's house. As he explained to Tom, "I gotta go to church and sweat and sweat. I hate them ornery sermons. I can't catch a fly. I can't chaw. I gotta wear shoes all Sunday. The widder won't let me smoke. She won't let me yell. She won't let me gape or stretch or scratch before folks. Dad fetch it, she prays all the time. I never see such a woman. I had to shove, Tom. I just had to shove." So in his own book, Huck moves away from the bars and shackles of civilization, that is Twain's phrase, and toward the river, that stream of freedom which Twain said symbolized the heaven pictured by priest and prophet. Once on the river, Huck tries to work out his own salvation, moving in an Adamic peacefulness back to a state before sin and civilization. "We was always naked day and night," Huck said, "whenever the mosquitoes would let us." From this mosquito-blemished Eden, Huck would occasionally venture into the world. But the men he found there were fallen indeed. The Grangerfords could read their Pilgrim's Progress and Presbyterian Observer, listen to Sunday sermons fit for printing in either, and then continue a senseless feud that would take the life of their handsome and attractive young son. In what is still the most chilling and understated description of death I know, Huck describes the horror of seeing his helpless friend shot down with a rifle like a duck on a pond. In addition to being mighty good to Huck, Buck Grangerford was a civilized alter ego for him. Same age, nearly same size, nearly same name. Buck's death was a brutal, vicarious reminder of life in that civilized world. I wish I had never come ashore that night to see such things, Huck confessed. I ain't never going to get rid of them. Lots of times I dream about those things still. Less personal but still repugnant reminders of traditional evangelical Protestantism are portrayed in the camp meeting and in the string of charades performed by the Duke and the Dauphin. The moral apex of the book is, of course, on the raft in that much explicated battle between Huck's sound heart and his slightly deformed conscience, a battle in which Huck determines to resist the sins of society if it will mean going to hell. Huck simply cannot take Jim back into civilization, for he himself has suffered bondage there, and he cannot wish that on anyone in good, that is bad, conscience. In their flight, Huck and Jim are quite literal soul brothers. But the brackets of civilization, which encase this story, inexorably begin to close in when Huck is socially born again into the society of the Phelps farm. You'll remember that Huck becomes Tom, Sid, Tom becomes Sid, and so on. The much-discussed conclusion of this book is, it seems to me, infinitely stronger than most critics have understood. It does, among other things, remind Huck and the reader how cruel, or at the very least how capricious, Miss Watson's kind of Presbyterian providence really is. After making a black-faced fool out of Jim, Tom, hiding as Sid, smugly reveals that Miss Watson had already set him free. It was precisely that kind of unaccountable and unaccounting God that Sam Clemens was never able to understand. With that reminder of such Calvinistic victimization reawaiting him, Huck Finn heads out for the territory, of religious and cultural unorthodoxy. Life would be more attractive, certainly freer and safer, out beyond the demarcated boundaries of civilization, where pale theology students from the East had very little to teach people like Scotty Briggs and Huck Finn. With the publication of that book in 1883, and Huck's intended, though undoubtedly never realized, return to the frontier, Mark Twain passed over a threshold at least as decisively as any double-minded man was able. When he put down his pen at the close of that manuscript, he was just 3 months away from his 48th birthday. A half dozen years before his death, he jotted in his notebook, "The man who is a pessimist before he's 48 knows too much. The man who's an optimist after he's 48 knows too little." Paul Tillich has suggested in his examination of history that the substance of culture is religion, and that the form of religion is culture. With only a modest shift in Tillich's meaning, that proposition was axiomatic for Mark Twain. Wearing shoes and going to church were the same thing to Huck Finn. And this child, who was father to the man, struggled to be rid of both. The man succeeded, or perhaps more accurately, acceded, only a few times. In the cabin of a riverboat, around the mining camps on the western frontier, under the moonlit sky of Galilee, with the love of a wife and children, and finally, full circle, on a raft again, floating down that first big, powerful river. In spite of the genuinely bitter pessimism that was ahead, that's somehow where Sam Clemens ultimately remained, on the river, on the line, in between, divided and dividing. He could not live with traditional American Protestantism, but he couldn't live without feelings of innate religious hunger either. East or West, so much was, in Huck's phrase, simply hogwash. But occasionally, there was that genuine soul butter, and he knew it. And he had an almost desperate need for it. As Huck said about this lifelong anxiety that always seemed to be marking Twain, I quote, "Sometimes the widow would take me to one side and talk about providence in a way to make a body's mouth water. But then maybe the next day Miss Watson would take hold and knock it all down again. I judged I could see that there was two providences, and a chap would stand considerable show with the widow's providence, but if Miss Watson's got him, there weren't no help for anybody. I thought it all out, and reckoned I would belong to the widows if he wanted me. Though I couldn't make out how he was going to be any better off than he was before, seeing I was ignorant and kind of low down and ornery. Sitting one evening in the darkened Hartford home of their friends, the Charles Dudley Warners, Sam and Livy Clemens watched a beautiful full moon rise outside the large bay window. The faithful Clemens housekeeper, Katie Leary, later reported. Suddenly, Mr. Clemens got right up without any warning and began singing one of them Negro spirituals. A lady that was there told me he just stood up with both his eyes shut and began to sing kind of soft-like, a faint sound, just as if there was a wind in the trees, she said. And he kept right on singing, kind of low and sweet, and it was beautiful, and it made your heart ache. And he kept on singing and became kind of lost in it, and he was all lit up, they said his face was. 'Twas something from another world, she said. And when he got through, he just put his hands up to his head, just as though all the sorrow of them Negroes was upon him, and he began to sing, Nobody knows the trouble I got. Nobody knows but Jesus. And when he came to the end, when he came to the glory, hallelujah, he gave a great shout, just like them Negroes do. He shouted out the glory, glory, hallelujah. They said it was wonderful, and they said none of them would forget it as long as they lived. And the world of American literature will never forget him. Thank you.